Picture this. You're standing in one of those sterile glass-walled conference rooms.
Oh, yeah. The classic tech interview nightmare.
Right. The air conditioning is just a little too cold. And
Yeah.
the interviewer, this senior engineer who frankly looks like they haven't slept since the last major product launch, they hand you a dry erase marker.
And you can hear it squeak as you uncap it. It's the loudest sound in the room.
It really is. So on the whiteboard, they've written a single array of integers and a surprisingly brief prompt. It just says, find all unique triplets in the array that sum up to zero.
Ah, yes. The dreaded threesome.
Exactly. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are tackling one of the most notoriously classic software engineering interview hurdles, leak code problem number 15, universally known as threesome.
It is a rite of passage, honestly.
It is. But we aren't here to just memorize a block of syntax, you know. We are taking this beast apart using a highly structured methodology called the six-phase framework.
Because without a framework, you're just guessing.
Right. So, okay, let's unpack this. When people hear leak code 15 or threesome, there's often this immediate visceral stress response.
Oh, absolutely. Total panic.
Yeah. So why is it so crucial to approach this specific problem with a formalized framework rather than just relying on like your intuition and jumping straight into writing code?
Well, jumping straight into code on a problem like threesome is essentially the equivalent of trying to build a house by immediately pouring concrete without, looking at a
You're
blueprint.
just making a mess.
Exactly. It guarantees structural failure later on. I mean, this specific problem is perfectly engineered by interviewers to punish impulsive coding.
So that stress response is kind of justified then.
It is completely justified if you're relying purely on instinct,
Yeah.
because threesome isn't merely testing your ability to find three numbers that add up to zero,
Right. It seems simple on the surface.
but it's not. It is explicitly designed to test your organizational thinking, your foresight, and really your ability to manage massive algorithmic complexity under extreme pressure.
Because there's so much going on under the hood.
Exactly. Without a structured methodology to contain it, the cognitive load of managing multiple pointers, dodging duplicate answers, and optimizing time complexity will simply overwhelm your working memory.
I want to dig into that perfectly engineered aspect because this problem acts as a massive filter for tech companies.
It's a gatekeeper problem for sure.
Yeah. And for anyone who might need a quick refresher on the mechanics, the naive brute force way to solve this is to just use three nested loops.
The instinctual approach.
Right. You just iterate through every single possible combination of three numbers in the array until you find the ones that hit zero. Easy, right?
Easy to write, terrible to run. I mean, mathematically, three nested loops gives you a time complexity of big O of n cubed.
Which is, I mean, that's bad.
It's catastrophic. To put that in perspective for an interviewer, if your input array has just 1,000 elements, 1,000 cubed results in 1 billion operations.
Wow, a billion operations for 1,000 numbers.
Right. The interviewer knows this is a terrible approach.
Yeah.
You know this is a terrible approach. They are literally just sitting there waiting for you to explicitly state that a brute force approach is entirely unacceptable for a production environment.
So it's almost like a test of your judgment before you even start coding.
Exactly. Threesome uniquely positions itself as a benchmark because the leap from that catastrophic big O of n cubed solution to the optimized big O of n squared solution, it requires a very specific deliberate shift in strategy.
It forces you to abandon the obvious path.
Precisely. You have to stop and think.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I see candidates trying to solve this without a solid plan, and it reminds me of trying to assemble a massive piece of IKEA furniture without the manual.
Oh, that is a perfect analogy.
Well, you might get a few pieces together, right? You
Yeah.
look at it, kind of seems like a drawer, you're feeling
But
confident.
you didn't look ahead.
Exactly. You didn't look ahead, and suddenly you realize you used the wrong dowels in step two, and now you have all these leftover screws. And the only way to fix it is to tear the entire thing down to the floorboards and start over.
And in an interview, tearing your code, I mean, people try. Trying to patch that bug by just slapping a hash set on your final output at the very end of the interview, it's exactly like realizing your drawer is backwards.
It's a hacky fix.
It's a messy, inefficient, desperate patch that the interviewer will immediately flag as poor engineering.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate for a second here.
Go for it.
Does focusing so heavily on a single, highly contained algorithmic problem, like threesome risk, I don't know, missing the forest for the trees, interview prep. Like, are we just training people to pass a very specific standardized test rather than training them to be functional software engineers?
That is a very fair question.
Yeah.
But if your goal is just to memorize the optimal Python or C++ solution to LeetCode 15, then yes, you are entirely missing the forest.
Because memorization is brittle.
Exactly. That rote memorization shatters the moment an interviewer slightly tweaks the constraints. And that is precisely why our focus today is on the six-phase framework.
It's about the process, not the specific problem.
Right. Mastering threesome isn't about memorizing the problem itself. It's about using the problem as a sort of high-resistance training weight to practice cognitive offloading.
Cognitive offloading. I like that.
Yeah, because under pressure, your brain's working memory shrinks drastically. The framework acts as an external hard drive.
So you don't have to hold it all in your head.
Exactly. You don't have to panic about what to do next because the framework dictates your next move.
Mm.
And that scales to any problem, whether you're in an interview or debugging a massive microservice architecture.
Okay, so the problem is really just the vehicle for the methodology.
Perfectly said.
So let's get into the vehicle and see how this engine actually works. When that 45-minute clock begins ticking, the first phase of this framework is to simply understand.
Phase one, understand.
But a lot of junior engineers stumble right out of the gate here, don't they? They hear the prompt, they nod silently, and they turn directly to the whiteboard.
Which is a huge mistake. Silent candidates fail.
That's a bold statement.
It's true. Phase one is entirely about actively communicating with the interviewer to define the absolute boundaries and edge cases of the problem. You are actively trying to find the walls of the sandbox.
So you have to ask clarifying questions out loud.
Out loud. And writing the answers on the board so both you and the interviewer have a shared contract of what is actually being built.
But I can see how find three numbers that sum to zero feels so self-explanatory that a candidate might just, you know, skip asking questions. What specific constraints should you actually be interrogating here?
Well, the edge cases are where the bugs live. You need to ask, what happens if the array is empty?
Good point.
What if there are fewer than three elements? Does the system expect an empty list, or should an error be thrown?
You can't just assume the input is clean.
Exactly. Are the integers bounded by standard 32-bit limits, or do I need to worry about integer overflow when I'm summing massive numbers together?
Oh, overflow, that's a classic trap.
And critically, for this specific problem, you must ask if the input array is mutable.
Meaning, are you legally allowed to modify the original data passed into your function?
Right. Or do you need to operate on a copy?
That mutability question is huge because modifying an input array in a real-world production environment can cause, like, massive side effects for whatever other function was relying on that data.
It can bring down a whole system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for threesome, the optimal solution requires sorting the array first. So if the interviewer says the data is immutable, you have to allocate memory to create a copy, which fundamentally changes your space complexity.
Exactly. So once you establish those constraints, and let's assume the array is mutable for this exercise, and you've written down a few quick test cases to validate your understanding, you transition into phase two.
Which is match.
Right, phase two is match. Mm-hmm. This is where you match the problem's constraints to known algorithmic patterns. You're shifting from what the problem is to what tools can solve it.
This requires serious pattern recognition because we know the brute force is three nested loops. But the classic prequel to this problem is twosome, right? Where you just need to find two numbers that hit a target.
The foundational problem, yeah.
And in twosome, the golden rule is to use a hash map. You store numbers you've seen, and you check if the complement you need is in the map. It's incredibly fast.
Very fast.
So naturally, why can't we just wrap the twosome hash map logic in a single loop and call it a day for threesome?
What's fascinating here is that phase two forces you to evaluate that exact trade-off out loud.
You have to talk through the temptation.
Yes. You can technically use a hash map.
Mm.
But remember those duplicate triplets we discussed?
Right, the leftover IKEA screws.
Exactly. If you use a hash map, avoiding those duplicates becomes an absolute nightmare of spatial overhead.
Really? Why is that?
Well, you have to store your triplets in another hash set, then sort the triplets themselves to ensure uniqueness and handle hash collisions.
Oh, that sounds awful.
It is. It balloons your space complexity and makes the code virtually unreadable. So you verbally explain this trap to the interviewer. You say, I could use a hash map, but deduplicating the results will cost extra space and time.
So by doing that, you've shown you understand the tool, but you're actively choosing a better one.
Exactly. And that better pattern is sorting combined with two pointers.
I want to pause on the sorting aspect, though, because choosing to sort an array before looking for sums is a massive conceptual leap for a lot of people.
It's not intuitive at first.
No, it isn't. Why does sorting the array suddenly make finding a sum of zero so much easier? Like, how does the underlying logic of that actually work?
Well, think about the absolute chaos of an unsorted array.
Just random numbers everywhere.
Right. The numbers are completely random. If your current sum is positive, you have absolutely no idea where in the array to look to find a negative number to balance it out.
You're just guessing blindly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sorting imposes order on that chaos. Once the array is organized from smallest to largest, you gain complete directional control over your search.
Directional control. Okay, so if we need to go smaller, we move left. If we need to go bigger, we move right.
You got it.
And that bridges us right into phase three, which is plan. We've matched the pattern, we know we're sorting, but we aren't writing real syntax yet, are we?
No, absolutely no code yet.
We're writing plain English or pseudocode. So how do we explain the two-pointer approach for threesome to an interviewer without getting bogged down in syntax?
You verbally walk them through the physical mechanics of the algorithm. You explain that you will iterate through the newly sorted array with a standard loop tracking a current number.
Okay, so that's our anchor.
Right. And for every number you lock in, you set up two pointers for the remaining unexamined portion of the array. A left pointer sits right next to your current number, and a right pointer sits at the very end of the array.
And because it's sorted, that left pointer is always pointing to the smallest available number in our search window, and the right pointer is anchored to the largest available number.
Exactly. Then you calculate the sum of those three specific numbers. If the sum hits exactly zero, great, you've found a valid triplet.
But what if it doesn't?
Well, if the sum is a negative number, meaning the total value is too small, you have to make a decision about how to increase that value using the order you just created.
So we have to move our left pointer to the right, because moving to the right in a sorted array inherently gives us a larger number.
Exactly.
It's literally like tuning a dial on a stereo, isn't it? If the music is too quiet, you turn the left dial up. If the sum is too large, meaning it's too positive, so we move the right pointer down to the left to grab a smaller number and reduce the volume.
I love that. That tuning a dial metaphor is highly effective in an interview setting because it proves total mastery of the mechanism.
You aren't guessing.
No, you're reacting to the data state. But your plan must also explicitly state how you will handle the landmines, the duplicates.
Right, we can't forget those.
In your pseudocode, you write out the logic. You say, if my current number is the exact same as the number before it, I skip it entirely.
Just bypass it.
Yep. And you also write, when a valid triplet is found, I advance my left pointer, and if that new number is the same as the old one, I keep advancing until I hit fresh data.
So you map out every single landmine before you even walk onto the field. The plan is solid, the interviewer agrees with the logic.
And only then do you move forward.
Right. Phase four is implement. This is where we finally translate that plan into actual code on the whiteboard.
And because you invested so much cognitive energy into phase three, phase four should feel almost mechanical.
You're just doing translation at this point.
Exactly. Yeah. You are no longer problem solving.
Yeah.
You're simply translating your English blueprint into Python, Java, or C++ TAC. You write clean, modular code.
Yeah.
And you use descriptive variable names.
No single letters.
Right. You don't just use X and Y. You write out current sum, left pointer, right pointer.
And crucially, you don't stop talking. Like, you don't just go dead silent for 12 minutes while you write, leaving the interviewer staring at your back.
Oh, that's the worst. Narrating your translation is vital.
Just saying what you're typing.
Right. Saying things like, now I'm setting up the while loop for the two pointers to ensure they don't cross. It keeps the interviewer engaged.
And it probably saves you if you mess up.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
If you make a minor syntax error, an engaged interviewer will often just point it out and let you fix it immediately rather than letting it sit there as a silent strike against you.
Okay, so we finally have code on the board. The natural human instinct is to drop the squeaky marker, throw your hands up, and declare victory.
The urge is strong.
But phase five is review. Now, I have a real issue with this phase, actually.
Oh, why is that?
Honestly, in a high-pressure 45-minute technical interview, stopping to manually review everything feels like burning daylight. Like, doesn't this strict six-step process, especially doing a manual dry run at the very end, actually slow a candidate down when the clock is mercilessly ticking?
I get that. It feels slow right up until minute 35.
What happens at minute 35?
The candidate who skipped the planning and review phases to write code faster is now staring at a wall of spaghetti code, trying to figure out why their output has three identical sets of zeros, and their adrenaline is spiking because they have no idea where the logic broke down.
Oof. Yeah, that's a nightmare scenario.
It is. You aren't losing time by following the framework. You are buying an insurance policy against a catastrophic 11th-hour rewrite.
That makes a lot of sense.
Phase 5 allows you to catch your own bugs before the interviewer points them out. Catching your own logic flaw demonstrates extreme ownership.
Because the dreaded scenario is when you say you're done and the interviewer just looks at the board and asks, "Are you sure this works?"
That phrase haunts the dreams of software engineers everywhere.
It really does. So how do we review this effectively without bogging down into a tedious math problem out loud? A lot of candidates try to hold an entire array and three moving index numbers in their head, and they just overload their own working memory trying to explain it.
Well, instead of doing the arithmetic out loud for every single step, you use phase 5 to simply show the engine running.
Show the engine running?
Yes. You take a small sample array and you verbally demonstrate your decision tree. You point to your current number, you point to your left and right dials, and you state the mechanism.
So you say something like, "Because my sum is negative 2.
Exactly. Because my sum is negative 2, I know definitively I must turn the left dial up. There's no guesswork.
You're proving to the interviewer that your dials don't get stuck.
Right. And that your duplicate skipping logic actually fires when it's supposed to.
You're showing them the architecture handles the stress test. You track the state of the pointers to prove you didn't just memorize a solution from the internet, but that you deeply understand the mechanics of the machine you just built.
Which is exactly what they're looking for.
Which leads us to the final hurdle, phase 6, evaluate.
Evaluate is where you formally state the time and space complexity of your finalized code using big O notation.
But you don't just state the final answer, right?
No, you explain the mathematical reasoning behind it clearly.
Okay, so for our optimized threesome, our time complexity is big O of n squared. But wait, we sorted the array at the very beginning of the algorithm.
We did.
And sorting an array takes big O of n log n time. So why isn't the final complexity an amalgamation of both? Like, why is it just O of n squared?
That is a classic trap interviewers use to see if you actually understand asymptotic notation.
Oh, really? So it's a trick?
Sort of. You have two sequential operations happening in your code. First, the sort, which runs in O of n log n. Second, the nested loops for your pointers, which run in O of n squared.
Right, they happen one after the other.
Exactly. But in big O notation, we are concerned with how the algorithm performs as the size of the input data scales toward infinity.
As n gets really, really big.
Right. As n gets massive, n squared grows exponentially faster and consumes vastly more compute time than n log n.
So the sorting step just becomes negligible.
The lesser term becomes a mathematical rounding error. Therefore, we drop the less dominant term, and the n squared operation completely defines the time complexity of the algorithm.
That makes perfect sense. The biggest bottleneck dictates the speed limit of the entire highway.
Great way to phrase it.
What about space complexity, though? Because we didn't use a hash map, our space complexity should just be big O of 1, right? Constant space, since we just use a few pointers.
Actually, space complexity is highly nuanced here, and discussing this specific nuance shows incredible architectural maturity.
Oh, how so?
The space complexity heavily depends on the underlying sorting algorithm used by the specific programming language you are coding in.
Wait, really? The built-in sort function changes the complexity.
It does. If you were writing in Python, the native sort function uses an algorithm called TimSort.
Okay, TimSort.
TimSort is a hybrid sorting algorithm that performs exceptionally well on real-world data, but it takes O of n space in the worst-case scenario to manage its internal subarrays.
Oh, wow. So it's not constant space at all.
Yeah. Not in Python. Conversely, if you're writing in C++A, the standard sort function uses intrasort, which operates entirely differently and only takes O of log n space.
That is an incredible detail to know. Pointing out that space complexity is dictated by the architectural choices of the language designers under the hood, that is a massive signal to an interviewer.
It really is.
It shows you don't just know how to use the tools, you know how the tools themselves were manufactured.
Exactly. It elevates you from a coder who solves puzzles to an engineer who understands systems.
So what does this all mean for you as you prepare for your next technical screen? Conquering algorithmic benchmarks like LeetCode 15, the dreaded threesome, is not achieved by staring at an optimal solution on a monitor until you've burned every character into your memory.
That will just lead to burnout.
It will. It is achieved by relentlessly applying a structured step-by-step approach. The six-phase framework. Understand, match, plan, implement, review, evaluate.
It's all about consistency.
Right. This framework is a deliberate cognitive tool designed to eliminate information overload. It takes the sheer panic out of the interview room because, no matter how complex the prompt is, you always know exactly what your next step is supposed to be.
And you have to wonder, if a classic, highly contained array problem like threesome benefits so immensely from a strict six-phase cognitive offloading framework, how might applying that exact same rigorous step-by-step methodology change the way you approach open-ended debugging in your day-to-day engineering work outside of an interview room?
That is a brilliant thought to leave on. The methodology doesn't just pass interviews, it fundamentally builds better engineers. The next time you find yourself staring at a blank whiteboard or a completely blank IVE and that visceral stress response kicks in, just remember you don't need to see the whole house. You just need to look at the blueprint, grab your marker, and start with phase one. Thanks for exploring the deep dive with us today. Keep building, and we'll catch you next time.